Hey everybody, this is just a quick note about this episode. We recorded this episode several months ago with Cameron Hurley, and due to some personal stuff which I mentioned in a previous podcast, I haven't been able to get it out. So now it's getting out, which is late. There's some references to when her book came out. Obviously the book's already out. So yeah. In terms of the backlog of stuff, well, we're basically caught up. There's one more Torture Cinema episode, which we recorded late anyway. And that's it. There's nothing outstanding as far as I recall. So we're all caught up. You'll be getting a few more episodes between now and Christmas. So yay. And yeah, so that's it. So I appreciate, you know, your patience as I go through this horrible process. And I also appreciate folks that have been supporting us, you know, on Patreon or by just saying that they love us or suggesting us. If you've suggested us on Twitter, I think I've responded to everyone who suggested us. I really appreciate the word of mouth. That's really awesome, guys. So thank you for that. And yeah, that's it. So I hope you enjoy this episode.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
The high in the wool epic fantasy with Cameron Hurley.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guest today is none other than Cameron Hurley. Hello, Cameron.
Hello!
Did I mispronounce the high?
The high?
Am I doing the pun wrong? The high. D-H-A-I?
Oh, die.
Die. So so my pun doesn't work.
No.
So it
should be die in the wool. Epic fantasy. Okay. So I pronounced the H that I should not pronounce.
Yep.
Sorry, listeners.
That's you know what?
Now
it's
we
okay.
Know. I was just kind of listening going, okay. Yeah.
But it works now. Yeah. Okay. So we're here to talk about the second book in your series, Empire Ascendant. We talked to you for the first book at Convergence last year, but it hadn't even come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of like, spitting in the dark a bit, which is fun, but now that we have some meat that we can talk about, I kind of want to start with kind of a general question about writing a sequel to what many have described as a very ambitious and kind of insane book, the first of your books. I think it's a fair assessment to a degree. It is wildly ambitious and pretty insane and kind of awesome for it. And now kind of writing a sequel, did you find that a particularly difficult process?
Yeah, I think for me, much of the what made this so tough was certainly it was written to deadline. I had about 12 months to write it. But then more than that, it was making sure that this was a story that incorporated all the viewpoint characters that I wanted and that things needed to happen at certain particular points in time. There are some big astronomical events. There are large events that happens in the sky. Astrological. Man, it's only like 8 o'clock. I think we're all thrown off. So anyway, there's shit happening in the sky and, lots of different characters. They're all of their viewpoints all needed to line up at certain points of time. And it was very difficult to kind of plot out how that was going to happen and how the people were going to pull off all the things that needed to be pulled off in time to get to the end. It actually went through tons of editing with my agent. And then again, we ended up putting the viewpoint characters and things in certain ways where then my editor came back and said, this still doesn't make sense. We should probably reorganize these again. And honestly, that was probably the biggest trouble, was trying to figure out where everything goes within the narrative so that it makes total sense to the reader. As everybody knows, again, it's a complex fantasy series. There are literally multiple worlds at play, multiple versions of different characters. There are a lot of characters, a lot of viewpoints. I've had a lot of people compare it to like Steven Erikson's books. So there's a ton going on, and keeping all of that straight and telling a good story while keeping all of that straight was certainly a challenge. I knew with this one that I really wanted it to be like The Dark Empire Strikes Back for the series. And it definitely was that. And I was pretty happy about it. So you definitely have to be somebody who kind of, you know, likes to, I think as one reader said, I asked for the blood to rain down and the blood rained down. So if that is not the kind of book that you like, then you're probably not going to like it. But if you like that stuff, it definitely, you know, was my goal to make it deliver.
Yeah. I mean, this book opens, I mean, the prologue for it is a pretty gruesome scene. I don't think we're ruining anything by talking about it because it's since like the first 10 pages, where we have a battlefield and they're basically hunting down the people who survived the initial battle and like harvesting their blood, which is a particularly horrifying scene. And I think it gives a sense of Kirana as a particularly ruthless kind of character. Which in a way fits into the world, but is also really drastically contrasted to the characters that follow, even when they are themselves fairly ruthless. They're just ruthless in much more less subtle ways, I suppose. She's like the Emperor to the others, or maybe more like Darth Vader to the others, since you made the Empire Strikes Back that comparison. I think Darth Vader, right? He's sort of less nuanced than maybe the Emperor, even though we know the Emperor is the most evil. starting off a book with such visceral imagery, I know your books have been compared to like sort of well, you've described it as kind of grimdarky, but with your own kind of spin on it, and kind of weaving this sort of bloodiness in with, you know, essentially a lot of very deep character development throughout. What was the process for you for kind of putting all of those, I mean, you talk some of it about this, right, and kind of trying to keep the multiple POVs together while telling a narrative, but at the same time telling, you know, these kind of character arcs at the same time in what is sometimes very fragmented, right? We're jumping from character to character to character.
You know, it was certainly a challenge. I outlined all of these character arcs and, you know, what needed to happen to each character throughout the course of the series. What each character wanted and whether or not they achieved it, knowing their eventual end. So it was good to, you know, when I sat down, knowing where everybody actually needed to end up. One of the things I actually went back and added, you know, the first 150 pages were actually just people talking. It was just people talking. So, it was one of those things where I said, okay, well, if folks are, folks are just talking, like that's not very interesting. So I need to go back in and I need to add in all the amazing things. So I went in and I added like fights with sentient trees and I added in assassins who cross worlds. You know, that whole first prologue was initially just, it was just Kirana and Yasuo talking. And there was none of the other stuff in there. So, one of the things that I like to do is sort of get the, story itself, down first. And then I go back in and I start to layer in the worlds and, some of the more interesting scenes and things, after that. So, that's kind of just kind of how I approach it. I think it's a very layered effect. And I talk about this with God's War as well, where that book was mostly just fight scenes and dialogue when I first wrote the first draft. And then I kind of went back in and I added all the world building on top of it. So I'm very much a layered writer. There's a first draft that's kind of bare bones. And then you go back again and again and again until you finally kind of flesh out this beast.
Paul, you wanted to jump in here.
I did, because I wanted to dig a little bit more into the tale of how you... weaved and decided where characters were going to wind up throughout the course of the novel. I mean, how much, given the complexity of the first novel and given the complexity of this novel, how much did you wind up changing on the fly from when you started writing this novel to where everybody ended? Because some really dark things happened to some of your characters.
I knew pretty much who was going to die at the end of this one, and the horrible, and some of the horrible things that would happen to them along the way. So that really didn't change too much. I think there was at one point where I was like, I really didn't want someone to die who needed to die. And I said, do I really need to do this? I was like, yes, you really need to do this. So I did need to kind of follow that through. So a lot of the character deaths were pretty much, I think there was only one that kind of surprised me, but I was kind of like, by the time I got to the end of the book, I was like, it's time to end this character's arc. We're done. And so I ended it. but yeah, there was a lot of, when I outline books, it's like the big pieces generally stay the same. I know the big things that are going to happen. It's rare that those get knocked out of the way. It's the kind of the little stuff and the little side quests and things. All of Rose chapters, were pretty much kind of on the fly. I knew that there were things he needed to find out. There were pieces he needed to do, but what actually happened to him and where he ended up going was completely new. I just literally just sat down and just started writing, and it was like, and now we're off to do this. And now, oh, I've been captured. So, so I allowed that to be much more, organic. There were some of them that could be a little bit more organic, because they were sort of ancillary stories that it had a piece of information that I was going to need, for book three. And I allowed them to have a little bit more room to breathe, which I really like.
Sure. And I mean, we've been talking about, I've been joking about you with you on Twitter and promoting your book as The Empire Strikes Back. So did you approach this novel writing and thinking you were going to put yourself much more in Karana's and that side's viewpoint as your default and having anyone else react to that? Because the first novel felt to me like, okay, we have this world and we have incursions upon it. This one almost felt more like people had to be much more reactive because you had Karana in the driver's seat here, that Empire Strikes Back thing. Karana's making people make decisions and make terrible choices and have terrible things happen to them. And I wasn't even the most thinking before the character does. I was thinking about a certain thing that happens to a certain character that was like, wait a minute, she did that to her? What? Ah! You couldn't have. You did.
Yeah, that was probably planned.
Yeah, you certainly got my attention. Like, holy crap! So did you switch that sort of viewpoint so you were basically in Karana's driver's seat for writing?
I wanted to, like, the first book is all set up of, hey, these are our protagonists, these are our heroes, this is our world, horrible things are about to happen to them, the genocide is on. What I wanted to do in the second book was to remind people that we are not facing a faceless evil. These are not people who, you know, are like a faceless horde. These are literally the characters who, some of whom had died in the book before, and this is their version in the other world, right? So I wanted to make sure that I humanized them, and they needed to be as human as possible, and they needed to have really clear character motivations that made us, you know, sympathize with them and understand why it was that they were doing the things that they do. I think the best villains that you have are the villains who believe that they're heroes. This was very much Karana's story for me. She has a vision, you know, in that prologue, and we sort of follow her arc there right up until the end. Of what, you know, she's trying to accomplish. And so this to me was very much, it is called Empire Ascendant, and it is the Empire's story. That said, you know, we certainly get tons more again of all the other characters in the first book, but the main driving arc was this is what she's been working for 10 years to try and do. And unfortunately, the only thing that will save her people is to murder, you know, an entire world of other people. But darn it, she's worked for 10 years for this, to save them all and save her family. When we talk about history and we talk about, people doing horrible things, a lot of it is, you know, we forget that the people who do horrible things are actually people. We think there's something wrong with them and something really off. And the reality is that, you know, folks in Nazi Germany are normal people. Like, they were completely normal. What got them to do the things that they did are things that any of us could be compelled to do. And I think that's very important for us to remember, as we go forward, is that we have all of those things within us. It's not something crazy and monstrous. It's something that we all have the capability to do. And it's us needing to choose at every single turn not to do those things and to make different choices.
Not a banality of evil, but a humanity of evil.
Yeah.
Sean.
Yeah. So Well, like 8,000 things just came up that I want to talk about. So now I have to pick one to start with. And I'll start with what you were just saying, because I was just talking about this recently, this idea that, you know, like there's this idea of Godwin's law, right, with the internet. Like, you know, someone brings up, like, you know, Obama's like Hitler, or you know, George Bush is like Hitler. And this happens in all internet conversations. Someone brings up a Hitler reference, and usually that's the point at which you can say, well, now we're no longer dealing with an honest debate because you're being ridiculous. Because you are, because you're making a facile comparison. But I also think that there's this other aspect of that, which is that we often talk about Hitler or like Pol Pot or Stalin or, you know, pick any super evil dude or person or whatever, right, in the history of time, and we want to reduce them to something that's not human, so that it's easy for us to separate ourselves from that person or entity, rather than admit that there are qualities in that thing that are in all of us, and it's just, for some reason, and we should maybe describe why there's this reason, we are not doing the things that they're doing. And it can't just be merely because we've decided they're all just monsters, and they're not human, so therefore we're human, so we don't do it. No, because people we consider to be human do holy crap awful things all the time, right? People who commit mass murders, they snap and they kill people, or in some cases, they feel perfectly justified in killing a bunch of people. People do this. This is a human condition. And I feel like I'm going on a rant, but sorry. I feel like when we reduce it to these black and white comparisons, we lose any usefulness out of the example versus if we just talked about, like, look, the Nazis did evil shit, and we can talk about it on a moral basis and say, yeah, they did evil stuff, but we also have to talk about them as people who were coaxed into it through a history of bigotry and hatred and other factors, right, which would be either in their control or beyond their control, so that we don't repeat those mistakes, you know, presumably to another group that we've decided needs to be exterminated for some stupid ass reason. There I go, reducing it, but yeah.
No, well, and I think it's true. It's like we use Hitler as the boogeyman, right? Hitler as the monster under the bed. And in fact, you know, this is actually a real human person. And, you know, these are entity, these are people that we could all become. So yeah, I agree. It's true. And I don't know what the, you know, some of it is that it's just so much easier for us to say that someone else, and it's something other, and it's something I could never be. And it's much easier to do that than to interrogate the, you know, the why that it happened and to prevent it from happening again. So.
Yeah. We don't look in the mirror enough, I guess.
Yeah.
Just really, I mean, people talk about the Nazis is the great example, right? Because the people will talk about Hitler and they'll just think like there's something unique about their hatred of the Jews. And if you look at the history books, it's like, no.
No, not at all.
Western Europe turned away tens of thousands of Jewish refugees knowing they were going to concentration camps. I don't know whether they knew they were going to be, like, murdered en masse, but they knew they were going and a lot of them were going to die. So they sent them back because they didn't like Jews in that period. This was rampant. Anti-Semitism was rampant.
Yeah, there was a whole lot going on, right? Because it was you know, it was a program of you know, and eugenics was huge then, and eugenics was huge in all of Western civilization. That the United States was big on eugenics. But anyway, it's a very long and complex history, and very depressing, but also good to keep in mind, because I feel like every time that we come up to the edge of almost repeating that, it is actually good to bring up these examples, because I do see us all the time. Oh, we should put, you know, so-and-so in camps. And I'm like, whoa. And we bring up these examples because it's very, very easy for people to just go, well, it's just this one thing, and it's just, this is a separate thing, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so they are good historical examples, and we do need to remember that we do need to talk about them. So as much as we say, oh, hey, this is hyperbole and shouldn't be brought up, you know, it's kind of good to kind of bring it up occasionally and say, hey, let's stop this now before we gotta get out of control. And we're all storming through a parallel universe and destroying our doubles. I mean, no one wants that. Who wants that? No one.
Well, presumably some, like maybe 1%. But
yeah, the 1% of crazy people.
The 1% of people who really do want to murder and maim and destroy. I don't know if it's 1%. I'm making up a number. This is science, after all.
But as Cameron pointed out, and you read in the book, the Empress, I mean, it's hard for me to say for the best of intentions, but she's got, the Empress has a reason for doing this. I mean, this celestial event's going to wipe out her world. She knows that.
Yeah. And
so emigration, she feels, is the only rational thing, but in the way Cameron set up her universe, emigration means you have to kill the double on the other side. It just otherwise does not work.
And that's, you know, a lot of this book and a lot of the different things that I concentrated on in this book were giving people, they had a lot of bad choices. There was no good choices that they had. And so they were sort of left making the best of the bad choices. And it was, well, we can all stay here and die and be murdered by this celestial event, or we can go on and commit genocide against other people and try to survive the celestial event. Like that was their choice. There was no other choices. There were no good choices for them. And I set that up for a lot of people. I talk about a lot that, you know, I was playing Mass Effect 3, while I was working on these books. And it's such a great, lots of people have problems with the ending. I love the ending because it's like, they're all horrible choices. They're all just crap. And you're like, are you kidding me right now? But it makes sense within the context of the story. And with, you know, you are being faced with a horrible evil. You're being faced with something that really does want to absolutely wipe you out and destroy you. The choices that you are going to be left with, even fighting the hardest that you can fight, are all going to be bad choices. And that was kind of what I presented to all of my characters in my books, is that, yeah, this is going to be rough and you're going to have to make some choices. And your choices that you have all suck. I'm sorry. Welcome to the Cameron Hurley novel.
Yeah, and I like that idea because it, you know, rather than a kind of black and white where the answers are clear, we're presented with a moral dilemma where no choice we make is, well, we can make maybe an argument about maybe the less evil choice is the more moral one, but they're still all morally repugnant ideas. Yes. And that presents that problem, right? That we often miss in not having the nuances. One of the things that I did want to talk about is, I really thought that one of the, oh, great. I'm dropping stuff. That's lovely. One of the things I really thought was the main or theme throughout this book is not just this idea of this sort of the moral dilemma of bad choices, but also something that, Yisao says in the prologue where he says, I'm afraid of what we've had to become to survive this, which I think goes through to almost all of your POVs in the novel of the things that people have to do for survival. But what that ultimately does to them for good and for bad, right? In the case of Yisao and the Taimora, I mean, they're committing horrible acts of murder, mass slaughter, and the consequences of that on the human psyche are severe. And so there is a legitimate fear, but there's also this problem, but you have to do these things to survive. And so how do you mitigate the damage that you're doing to survive and yet doing evil or doing bad things or things you recognize are bad without having any choices? And I think that's one of the, I mean, I don't know if you agree, Cameron, but that's what I saw as one of the main thematic points of the whole novel.
Yeah. One of the things I really wanted to explore, and especially with, you know, the Dai who are a pacifist culture, is it really going to be worth it, for you to basically become everything that you are against and everything that you hate in order to try to win against a much greater and much more violent force? Because in order to win, they're going to have to change, and they're going to have to be very different, and they're going to have to go against their entire moral code. Is it worth doing that and becoming something else and surviving? And we do this a lot, a lot of science fiction. Oh, we have to have, we must survive at all costs. You know, the humans go out and colonize places, and we must, you know, humans must spread like a virus. And I'm like, but is it really worth it? Is it worth it to them to do this? Should they just say, you know what? That is not what we're going to choose to do. And we're going to get on a ship and go somewhere. We're going to, find some other way. We're going to die quietly. We're going to hurl ourselves off cliffs like lemmings. There are all sorts of different ways that they could do it. And figure and take control of that situation and of the, you know, people that they, you know, want to be and who they want to retain. And unfortunately, you know, they're again faced with horrible, bad choices. And so I'm very interested to kind of explore this idea in this sandbox, is how they are going to, you know, persevere and retain their culture or not. Depending on the choices that they make here, you know, coming up in this book and of course in book three. And it's something that I'm exploring. And again, it's as everyone has said, it's a dark book. There's a lot of dark stuff. People ask me all the time, like, so like, you don't sound like you're having a lot of fun writing these books. I was like, well, you know, they're written to deadlines, so they're tough. And it's not about having fun for me. It's about, this was a story I felt needed to be told, and it was an exploration that I really wanted to do, and something that I'm very passionate about. It's not always fun. Sometimes it's really hard. Sometimes it is fun. There's some, you know, Lilia and Tegan dialogue that's really fun. There's great fight scenes. But the, you know, the moral questions here in this entire series are incredibly deep and complicated, and uncomfortable to talk about. You know, I talk about on other podcasts and impose some things about, you know, again, especially this issue of genocide. And, it's really deep and depressing and complex stuff. And it does make people kind of go, it makes people ask questions, about themselves and about history. I think that, that kind of make us squirm in our seats, which, you know, get for better or worse. But for me, it was a story that I really needed to tell.
Well, and I'm glad you did. Because it gives me something good to read, so.
There you go.
I find it interesting you're describing, you know, the difficulty that you had with writing this. I mean, you know, not specifically the actual act of writing, right? Like the sitting down and putting your butt in seat, which I assume is hard also. But that you describe specifically certain types of scenes in the book were quite difficult because of the type of content we were talking about. And I like that distinction because it's not one that, you know, I think we often talk about is, you know, how the author may struggle with certain content in the process of writing. We sort of just assume that they enjoy what they write, which I think leads us sometimes to assume also that, that the things they write are a reflection of themselves, which is nonsense because I don't think that's always true.
or what they believe. I believe Larry Niven terms such a idea as being idiotic, that you think that whatever an author puts into a book is what they actually believe themselves.
Right, and if you read this book, it would say some horrible things about you, Cameron.
I know, right? Yeah.
Cannibalism, obligate cannibalism and carnivorous plants and weird magic from satellites and bloody battles and weird tombs with weird things going on. You learned a lot of new things. There's a lot of new stuff too. I was expecting, okay, this will be more of the same, and then you start throwing in all sorts of new characters and new problems for these worlds. It's like, oh God, now what?
Well, you know, I did that in the God's War books too. I think people were really happy that they could kind of sort of further explore the world, right? And that's what I wanted to do here as well. Is bring people in with some new viewpoints, some new, you know, direction on the world, because there's so much going on. And I have three books. That is all that I have, unfortunately. This was in my brain back when I was, you know, in my late teens, early 20s. I wanted this to be a 15 book series back when people actually did those. And it just, there was no way that I was ever going to be able to sell it as that. So this is what it ended up being. It's highly condensed. It moves very quickly. And there's a ton going on, and I'm trying to get in as much as I can without being horribly overwhelming, because some people really love it. Some people it's too much. And I'm kind of walking this balance the same way I did with Mirror Empire, you know, trying to, have just enough, not too much, to really kind of, you know, get people into it and enjoy it.
It's like a very dense chocolate cake. Well, it's a, like, just like
sometimes
just,
a little too rich. Yeah, yeah.
Almost like a little too rich. Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to read your books quickly.
Yes.
I can't just plow through them because there's just too much going on. You throw too much. Oh, okay. You throw a lot at the, too much. Sounds like Bajard vibe. I love this book readers actually because Cameron's work is the real deal. You don't coddle and collywaddle us. You just just drop us right into the deep end. It's time to, you said earlier before that people had compared you to Erickson. And Erickson does this at even longer length, where the first novel, Gardens, have you read Erickson?
I have tried to read Erickson. This is the hilarious part. I've tried to read Erickson and it's too complex for me.
Yeah. I mean, the first novel, Gardens of the Moon, yep. You have no idea what the hell is going on.
What is going on? Yeah.
What is this magic system? What is this empire? It takes two books just to figure out what the hell is going on in this universe. And it just keeps dropping bombs. You're a more compact version of Erickson's sort of, narrative, fantasy density, which is, so it's not for everybody, but for people who can handle Erickson should definitely see what you're doing. So I want to talk to you a little about parallel worlds. So you have at least two in the first novel, and this, we get intimations there are more. As you said, you expanded and exploded things. Like, well, wait, more? So I was curious, what sort of parallel world fiction have you read? Because I am a long time, as every listener knows, reader of Rogers Laz and these Amber Chronicles. So I've been cutting my teeth on this for decades. So I was curious what you've read.
You know, and that's a really hard question because I ended up writing a post, right, for the Barnes & Noble blog about parallel universe fiction. And what I found was it was actually really difficult for me to separate the difference between what is a parallel universe fiction versus a portal fantasy. Because to me, those are kind of different. Portal fantasy is like you are transported to a secondary world, and it has no relation to your world. Whereas a parallel universe is, it is like an alternate version of your world. And it's real, but sometimes in a lot of the books, like that's not clear. There's all sorts of different books that I can be like, oh, it's totally, again, Zelazny. Is that really a parallel universe novel? Or is that a portal fantasy? Right? Like, I don't know. Because I certainly read a ton of, I'm a huge fan of Zelazny. So that was certainly a big influence. You know, I've read other stuff, you know, Steve R. Donaldson's The Mirror of Her Dreams, which I actually hated and I threw across the room because stupid. But anyway, but that's another portal fantasy. And again, as a kid, right? As a kid, we read tons of portal fantasy, right? The kid is runs off to, you know, some other world. And I can't even, there were tons of them, but I can't even think of them right now with the titles. I think again, the portal fantasy and the parallel universe, the alternate timeline, it certainly has a very rich and kind of varied history in, science fiction and fantasy. And of course, you know, and I've talked about the iconic Twilight Zone episode that I watched, which was, about, you know, this woman kind of waiting, to get onto a bus, and she ends up seeing her double who is kind of crossed over from a parallel dimension, and she ends up going crazy and being hauled off to an insane asylum, and then her double takes her place and gets her new job and takes over her new life. And I think that this is fascinating to me because this parallel universe, mirror image doppelganger thing, and I guess, you know, again, the Philip Pullman books are a very good example of this as well, is really ingrained in science fiction. I think it really is science fiction fantasy. It really is has to do with our obsession with what if, right? Well, what if things were different? What if I was different? What if there were a place where things could be really different? That was just like here, only this one little thing has changed. So it certainly has a very, very long storied history for sure.
Have you ever seen the movie Coherence?
Coherence.
It came out a couple years ago. It's a little indie film.
Is this the one with the dude from Buffy?
Yes. It's the one with the dude from
Buffy. Yes, I love that show. I just saw that on Netflix like 2 months ago. And I was like, this is amazing. Everyone who reads Mirror Empire and likes it should really watch this this show. I love that show. I thought it was great. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Because it's dark and twisted, showing the past one might take and what one might do to try to get that for themselves. Have you seen it, Sean?
Nope, I miss all the good things.
Sean, on Netflix, you have to watch it.
Sean, you and David and possibly me should do this for Totally Pretentious. Coherence. Mm. It's a great movie.
Great movie. Yeah.
Okay, I need to watch it. I've just not seen it. I saw Butterfly Effect.
Which is also dark. That's time travel, not parallel universe. Time travel and changing a timeline. And that does go very dark, especially the the director's cut, which is even darker than the original. Yeah.
And a film that I think people unjustifiably hate.
Well, I think that's because of the actor.
He's not bad in that movie, though.
I don't think Ashton Kutcher is bad in it either, but you know, people have that visceral hatred of him, so they see that as like, I'm not gonna watch that. What the heck? Have you seen it, Cameron?
I've seen parts of it. It just didn't appeal to me. Yeah.
It's really about the consequence. I mean, it's not really about parallel universes, except in the sense that time travel could create alternate versions, but it is, I like that it's pretty uncompromising in the fact that, the main character, no matter what he does, things go terribly wrong because having the ability to change your past and trying to make it all better doesn't work. And in the, I think the DVD, like, alternate version of the ending, he basically kills himself when he's a child by suffocating himself as an umbilical cord.
Yep.
Because he decides that he's the problem. And if he just dies, then yeah.
Everything will be better. Yeah. It goes really dark.
This sounds like it, that's again very Looper, right? Where they tie into it's time travel and it's sort of parallel universe, just because it's alternate timeline thing. Cause you can change things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so why don't we switch topics? Because, we're talking the parallel worlds and we're talking about some of the darkness of your world. But I want to talk about something that I found really interesting, and we didn't get a chance to talk to you when we had you on for the first book because, well, we hadn't read the book, so we couldn't have talked about any of this stuff. I found it really interesting at one point in the book when you started using, neutral pronouns.
Mm.
Which came out of nowhere for me, in this work because, we're so used to reading he, she, him, her, and then suddenly you throw out, I'm assuming it's pronounced Z, and, you know, this is, you know, some people have done these kinds of things before, and I found my first reaction was I was really jarred in a bad way, and then I stopped and I thought about what you were trying to do and realized, but isn't that the point? Because I'm so used to these other pronouns. And I wondered if that's kind of when you originally did this in your work. I mean, was that kind of the intent, was to kind of, you know, just rupture that kind of standard binary, or were you trying for something else?
I always had in mind that I wanted to ease people into the third gender pronoun. I wanted to make sure that the first book, you only would hear it when it was from the point of view of a character who was in Seidwan, which had the third gender. So Morala actually uses this during her point of view when she talks about the third gender characters, where she talks about Luna, she talks about Drea, she addresses them in that pronoun. So I wanted to make sure it showed up so that you were like, oh, okay, well, that's weird. And it wasn't extreme, it wasn't crazy, it's not going to knock you out. Because I knew I needed to keep people to get them to read the second book. So I knew that when I got to the second book, I said, okay, I want to have a third gender pronoun, point of view character. It's not going to be a lot of chapters. I want to make sure it's a very short amount of time. You're not going to have like a third of the book this way, just enough to ease people into it, and then kind of page ahead and go, okay, it's only a few more pages. And then hopefully by the time you get to the end of it, you're kind of used to it and it becomes a little bit normal. And I wanted to do that, just as I want to do with all the rest of my work, is people have been using third gender pronouns, obviously, for a long time. People use them in real life. I know people use third gender and neutral pronouns. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to kind of write a story that was not from a tiny, tiny press, that was not considered like this esoteric feminist work, that is not going to be something that sold 3,000 copies or 500 copies, but like a mainstream fantasy novel that was marketed as a mainstream fantasy novel that actually used this in a way that was not like, oh my God, isn't this weird? But just like, yeah, this is totally normal. Remember in the first book, told you this was coming. And so it was very purposefully done in that I wanted to actually see if I could pull that off. Whether or not I do, you know, we'll see. A lot of people have said the same thing. They're just like, wow, it was so jarring. And then, okay, well, I kind of got used to it, which is how it is in real life. When we are presented with something that we don't understand, oh, my friend uses a they pronoun, that's really confusing for me, and I'm going to make a mistake, and that really sucks. But I want to be respectful to them And I totally understand that, you know, why they're doing that. And so I'm going to, you know, work hard and get used to it. And you get used to it. These are all things that we learn. And just because we learn them later in life doesn't mean that they can't be learned or that they're weird or that they're strange. It's just that it's different. So it was certainly something that I put in there with an eye toward, you know, doing something that might, that I knew would probably make some people uncomfortable, but I figured I have a lot of faith in my readers, a lot of faith that my readers, can, you know, handle a lot of stuff that kind of rolls at them. And with all the other things that you're dealing with, I'm like, you know what? The third gender pronoun thing is probably not going to be as much a big deal as kind of the other things that I do. So.
Yeah. I don't think it's such a small part of the book. I don't think it's completely and utterly disruptive. It was something, cause I've never heard it ever spoken in the real world. And I maybe read maybe a handful of stories in my entire life that have done anything vaguely like that. Right. I mean, the most recent example that didn't even use the third person was the ancillary series, mm-hmm, by Lucky. But I think that just, which just refers to everybody by the same pronoun. Yeah. So yeah, it's sort of one of those things where gender is just indeterminate versus having an intentionally neutral pronoun. But I think that's going to depend entirely on the individual, right? On its success, because that's going to depend on how well a person can kind of adapt to suddenly being presented with something that isn't in their day-to-day lives a normality.
Well, and you know, I think we're so funny in fantasy because we'll totally buy that you call, you know, a flying bear a gazorkulk. But, you know, you start calling something by a third gender pronoun or, you know, whatever, you're like, oh my God, I can't deal with that. But, you know, where's the, you know, flapjack stacker? You know, I'm like, come on, like, you know, we're not, you are all smart people. We're smart people and we totally got this. And so, yeah, so some of it, I think the reason it makes me feel uncomfortable is unlike, you know, again, oh, the bear is really an Orberix, is that it's not something that we have like a lot of us have a map to, like, we don't understand it. It feels very nebulous to us. And so the hope that is that, you know, as you kind of go through the novel, just like with any other thing that you just get used to it as you go. So.
Well, and that's kind of the point, right? You're presented with something that goes against how you normally speak or think, and you just have to incorporate it.
Yep.
Otherwise, well, then you're living a very strange life where you incorporate nothing new.
Nothing. Yeah. You live in a black hole. Yeah.
I mean, I know for me, like, I've met transgendered people and, you know, have screwed up pronouns, not even realizing I was using the incorrect pronouns and feeling really awful about that. And having to sometimes just ask, like, what should I be using? Because it's a situation that I don't meet a lot of trans people in my day to day life. So if I'm not actively searching for it, I don't have that information to incorporate it. And I'd rather avoid being completely, confused every moment. I just want to kind of get it down. You kind of have to ask and get help. Yeah.
And to me, and that's life, right? And I feel like there's some things in life we feel must be battened down, right? Like once I know this is what it is. And that's just not true. And I think that, yeah, we just feel it discombobulates us because we feel that, especially with the binary, where we feel like this is the way it is. There is the box. There is orange and red. There is blue and green. And the most hilarious part of that particular example is that, in fact, there's been some really fascinating research done on the way that we saw, that ancient people saw color, because there were not like names for like purple. It was like the orange, wine dark sea, right? Yeah, it was the wine dark sea. The sea was the color, same color as the wine. Like, they did not see those as different colors. And so they had a box for this is what, you know, this range of colors is called. And this is what this range of colors is called. And by creating the box, they made those colors, right? And so I feel like we've really, you know, we really do that with gender too, where we think it's, well, there's this box and this box. And in fact, there's this huge range. You know, I've done tons of research on, you know, biological, sex and culturally, you know, culturally, you know, prescribed genders and things like this. And like, there is this massive range, just like sexuality, where like, well, you can be gay or straight. Like there's no, and I bet there's this huge scale of like, you know, this huge range, and we don't acknowledge that. And I think, and my hope is that, you know, the more we get outside this idea that there are boxes and that there are things that are kind of, you know, set, that maybe hopefully that will be less discombobulated when we see things that are kind of outside the box. I mean, it's so something that you do, you know, when you're teaching toddlers, kids want to know, like, it is this or this. It is this or this. And we're hardwired to do that. So it totally makes sense. But unfortunately or fortunately, the world doesn't work that way. It's actually far, far, far more interesting, I think, than our brains can even like understand, which is why we try to use the boxes. So.
Well, yeah. And in some cases we create these rigid systems. And then when we are presented with someone who doesn't fit into that rigid system, the whole system goes into chaos. I mean, the example being the Olympics, right? You get people who are not really one gender over the other. Their genetics are, or excuse well, me, I, sex over
yeah.
another, right?
But and I, yeah, I have things to say about the whole, yeah, you know, women can do this kind of sport and men can do this kind of sport. We'll judge them differently. And that whole, that's all, yeah, it does. It throws everything in out of whack, so. And to me, it really reveals the problem, right? It's more and more with things like that, where it just kind of reveals how, you know, it's the emperor doesn't have any clothes on. You know, yeah. It's like, you guys, yeah. These are all fake things. And every time something like that comes up, it's like, you know, with the way that we've structured this society and the way we talk about these things is incorrect. And we really need to fix that. And I think we'll get there. I think we're talking about it more and that always helps. And again, as you know, Cheryl Morgan had a really great post that I was reading, you know, where she points out, she's like, you guys got to understand the way that we rigidly define gender and who's gay and who's straight, all this stuff is really in our culture is like, we are really obsessed with it. If you look back through history, they are far less obsessed with these sorts of things than we are. Things are far more fluid. People really, you know, are not as really crazy about it as we are. And so I think we really need to remember that is that there are all sorts of ways for us to live and be and do things. And fantasy, this is fantasy world. If we're not living and being and doing these things in fantasy, you know, and we can't even imagine it there, then how are we going to bring it out and live our lives with it? When in fact, historically, we have actually done that, but we need to be able to imagine it and remember it so that we can actually, you know, get to that place in the future.
Yeah. And I think you bring up the great point that you brought up, I think twice now, which is that, you know, this is not the real world. You're writing a fictional fantasy universe. And where else would you be able to kind of push the boundaries except, I mean, if not in this area, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the idea that you shouldn't do, like, don't use the neutral pronoun because, well, why? It's a fantasy world.
Fantasy world. I could use whatever, I could do whatever I want. I have a gazindadit in here. So I can have whatever I want.
People are riding giant bears. And fighting right? trees with like
there's
kill sacks on them.
Magic.
There's magic.
Magic from the stars.
Giant yeah. dogs. I mean, you know, it's weird. You said this earlier. It does seem so strange that to us is not. I mean, it's fantasy. We recognize it. Like there aren't any giant bears that we can ride with saddles on. But we recognize it's fantasy, and it may be somewhat fantastical. But for some reason. That is, as you said, right, more acceptable than if we maybe push like a gender paradigm, like push against it or push against some moral edict that we've assumed to be true or something that is from the real world that we just take for granted as true. But yet we'll accept a giant walking tree with a sack where it hides people.
I've got a theory though about that.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because the giant carnivorous plants, the armored bears, those elements are clearly fantastical and you're clearly making them up to populate your fantasy world. But fantasy and science fiction are generally genres that intentionally or not talk about our own society, our own culture, our own beliefs. So when you're introducing things like gender fluidity, neutral pronouns, the ideas that these things aren't simple binaries that we've been raised to believe. it seems clear to those who are threatened by this, the challenging of those binaries, that you're saying, well, this is what the real world is look like. I mean, we can accept the armored bears because there are no armored bears that are rampaging down the through the forests of Minnesota, thank God. But when you're saying gender is much more fluid than you think, then you're talking, you're reflecting it, holding up a mirror to our own culture, and that can make people very uncomfortable.
But here's the problem. I'm sorry, but like, dude, if you're sitting around, if someone's writing a medieval, this pseudo-medieval fantasy where all the women exist to sort of be romanced by the guys and or raped, and or they don't have anything useful to do in the story, like, that is a political statement. That says, this is the way the world is, this is how things go. Heinlein was a hugely political writer, hugely political. I love it when people bring him up as being like, oh, he was a pure fantasy writer without it, or a pure science fiction writer without any like bias. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this is like free love Heinlein we're talking about. Reed, have you read Heinlein? Do you know what it like that he was speaking from the politics of his time? We are all speaking from the politics of our time. There is no such thing as an apolitical science fiction or fantasy novel, because even if you write something that you're like, oh, everything is just like the way it is now, well, guess what? The status quo is not a neutral position. It's not a neutral position. So writing a bunch of fantasy novels just like every other fantasy novel is a political statement. Everything that you write says something about, you know, it's either challenging some kind of status quo or it is reinforcing a status quo. You can't get away from it. You're raised inside of your own culture. You're going to take, you know, all these things, you're going to put them in there. I would actually argue that the reason people have trouble with it is for this very, very simple reason. And that's that we are used to seeing people riding bears. Philip Pullman's books has people riding bears. There are other books with people riding bears. We have seen walking trees. That's Tolkien has his trees. We got the Ents. So we've seen a lot of these tropes in mainstream fantasy novels. Have we seen a lot of this gender? Like a lot of people talk about, right? The polyamorous cultures and the gender fluid characters. A lot in this book. And one of the reasons they talk so much about it is not that there has not been work like this. There's tons of feminist science fiction that has had this, but I feel it's that because it has actually gotten like some mainstream attention, we have moved an okay number of books for this type of book. It's not like a niche book that has sold 300 copies. So I think that it's coming from this place of like mainstream fantasy readers are just not used to it. And that's why there's kind of this like, wow, this is new and different and cool, which is what I wanted. I wanted this to kind of get out there. So that we, because the more that we books that we see like this, when Ancillary Justice did really well, I was like, yes, because this was the first time since Ursula Le Guin wrote Left Hand of Darkness that there was like a mainstream book that actually did anything like that was like major, you know, with gender that made people kind of like really uncomfortable, that kind of challenged people's worldviews about it, that actually sold a ton of copies. So I knew that, okay, like we're really starting to, you know, see kind of this sea tide change. I might be able to actually sell some books here and we could add to this conversation that we all really need to be having and kind of change the face literally of fantasy and science fiction and the things that are acceptable to talk about and that we're used to seeing. And it's not going to be so shocking to people. It's like, you know, gay marriage. My gosh, 20 years ago, if you would have talked to the people at Stonewall and said, did you know that in your lifetime, people are going to legally be allowed to get married in the United States of America? They would have laughed at you and said, you are freaking crazy right now. But it happened, and it happened in a very quick period. And we did it by, you know, putting people by being open, by talking a lot, by doing a lot of activism. It was a huge effort by a bunch of people speaking their truth, telling their stories, coming out and using their voices. And I feel that in order to change, you know, what we're talking about and what the conversation is in science fiction and fantasy, a lot of us have to come out and we have to kind of change those conversations ourselves, because they're not going to change, you know, just us sitting around going, well, it sucks. It's like, you got to go out there and you have to. Matt Wallace made a funny joke because he's Matt Wallace on Twitter today. And he's like, what did he say? So I'm like, yeah, that Cameron Hurley sure does work really hard. But, you know, as a straight white man, I know that I don't have to worry about any of that. It's a joke. Matt's a good buddy of mine. And I was like, yeah, Matt, I totally understand, because it's true. It's all true. When you're when you're fighting up from the outside and you're not writing something that people are used to seeing, you do have to work a lot harder. And it sucks sometimes. You're kind of like, you know, somebody earns out, you know, another fantasy novelist just recently earned out, you know, his 6-figure advance. And I'm just like, you know, banging my head on the table, but I'm trying to, you know, it's not my path. I'm trying to do something that's, my career path is very different and I have a very different end goal. You know, in my end goals in 20 years for this to really not be a big deal and for people to look back and say, gosh, that Cameron Hurley, that was what a quaint and antiquated little book that is. You know, like I don't want people to go, wow, revolutionary science fiction and fantasy. This is amazing. I want people to go, oh, that was so conservative. Like, that's what I want. So then I'll know that I've done my job, you know, helping to kind of change the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, you brought up like the gay marriage thing, and a big part of that, I think, was changes in how the media represented gay people, right? Because I'm not a media expert.
That did not happen organically. We always forget, right? Like with suffrage, we always forget that was a ton of activism, an incredible amount of work, people putting themselves at risk, losing their jobs, losing their loved ones to make that happen. Yeah.
But once it does start to happen on the kind of wide scale media, it becomes much more difficult for a culture to kind of ignore it. Because now it's, you know, it's in your TV shows.
I think even more than the TV shows. I think
it's in your living rooms, literally.
It's in your neighborhoods. I think really we've gone way off your books. That once people started knowing gay people in their day to day lives and seeing that, no, they're not the scary other. They're Bob down the street might love Ted, but he still cares about the football game, so he must be okay. So.
Yeah, I remember.
I really think that's what really has allowed this to happen.
Yeah.
And that was a huge, you know, it was a huge push, and it continues to be, you know, a huge push, obviously. But yeah, that's not something that just magically happens. That's people doing, you know, doing the work.
Yeah.
And putting themselves kind of out there and taking the hits for it. So.
So I will say an anecdote on this subject, and then we should maybe move on.
I know we're kind of going ranging.
We are ranging pretty far. I mean, it's related in a way, but yeah. It's just this, that, I think it's really ironic that the small town I lived in, where we had an anti-gay protesters, did more to show people gay people than gay people had done in that town in the history of gay people in that town. And by that I mean they used to sit on the side of the highway. This is the town called Placerville, California. Some people may have known it. If you've driven through Sacramento to Tahoe, you've had to stop in Placerville because it's the only town in the entire world that has 3 stoplights on a major highway. And so no matter what you do, you get stuck in Placerville because, period, you just get stuck. You're there for like, if you're trying to go anywhere cool, you're stuck for like 2 hours. Driving through Placerville. And these people would sit on the side of the road, you know, with their typical stuff like the Bible passages, and they would like say hateful things. But their method of doing so was to show a giant picture of 2 very happy gay men kissing. Very happy gay men, not like suffering gay men, just a seemingly innocuous picture of 2 gay guys kissing. And I always found that really amusing because these guys were disgusted by this, but yet felt it necessary to create a like 6x9-foot billboard of 2 people they found disgusting kissing. And then decided to stand in front of it for basically years. So it didn't work out for them. Thought you should know.
Whoop.
Wow. I totally killed the podcast.
You did not kill the podcast.
That was an anecdote.
Yeah. It was an anecdote.
Sure was an anecdote. Yep.
No. Anyway, okay, so let's move back to the book. Let's make it back to the book. Paul, I'm going to hand it to you.
Okay. So in dealing with a lot of your books, I mentioned that you like to smarsh the patriarch. And this novel, we get to see those differing power relationships again. And I was just curious how you were evolving and changing and highlighting the power dynamics different, so equal to our own, different than our own, partial to our own, and how how you go about designing those various points on the spectrum of patriarchy to gynarchy, practically.
I just started basically, you know, with the idea of wanting to kind of build all these very, very different societies. Wanting to build them in a way where they were actually very different, from the ones that, that we know. You know, Saidwan from the outset, I think kind of looks like a, recognizable patriarchal-ish place until you start actually listening to the kind of the conversations. I think Morella has a few conversations in there about, you know, the Atesa and about men and about women and kind of the hierarchy within that hierarchy, right? You got three genders. And so how does that all work out? And that's something that doesn't get explored a ton in the books, but it is something that, that exists that I think that there are assumptions made about how that society works that are not correct, but we'll get there. And then of course, you know, you have somebody like, you know, Saradin. Saradin's a brand new character in the book. I wanted to work a lot with Torden, and I wanted to have kind of very different histories for how that, particular country had gone, and having suddenly this guy who had these very firm beliefs about how everybody should be, coming in and kind of changing it and having, some backlash to what he was trying to do. And then, of course, you know, I wanted my kind of, you know, my free love die, doing their pacifist harmony, everyone loves each other thing, in a way that was full, still very full of conflict. And of course, you know, they're vegetarian cannibals. You want to make sure that, you know, everybody has, societies that are still very complex and that they don't feel like crazy tropes or anything like that. And then, of course, I have the Aldeans, which, you know, we'll get in more to with book three. So I really wanted to make sure that every single one that I worked with, you know, again, Dorna has its own issues, clearly, the violent matriarchy. And I just wanted to make sure that they were as different as possible. I didn't want to just redo, again, this whole idea that everybody just kind of goes, oh, well, of course, there's a patriarchy. Or if there's not a patriarchy, well, yeah, sure, women are equal and only in that occasionally you see a female soldier, which I always hate. I always hate bad world building like that. But like, yeah, there's this occasional female soldier. So, haha, that means women are equal in my world. That is not what that means. That's literally the only change they make. Everything else is the same. They come into their wives and their wives cook them dinner. And they maybe the occasional woman will pick up a sword and like, hey, women are equal. I'm like, you have no idea what else goes on to make women equal. Like, there's like, who's taking care of the kids? Who's taking care of all of the domestic duties? How are these split? Who's running the government? How are access to jobs? Are there other jobs that women and men can do? And if there are other jobs women and men can do, again, how are the children raised? These are questions that they never even bother to go into when they build their worlds, and drives me crazy. You can't just hand a woman a sword and say, now women are equal, which I feel is like something that we've kind of done, in our own society, where we've gone, oh yeah, women can totally do anything. And then we ignore all of the other systems that are currently in place. We ignore the old boy networks. We ignore all of the things that we have done. You know, the fact that we are literally the only industrialized nation that does not have, paid maternity leave. There are all sorts of things that we do that actually completely, you know, make it really difficult for women to actually be equal. And then we say, yeah, but I gave you a sword. You can go to college. What else do you want? And you're like, what, are you kidding me right now? So you know, it's like, hey, I'll give you a job, and then we'll relentlessly, you know, be sexist to you, until you finally quit or get a new job. And it's like, that's not an equal society. So I think people really need to sit down and think about that when they're building their worlds, is what kind of a world are you building, and what does it actually mean? What is equality if your society is equal? And if they're not equal, you know, how does that kind of balance out? What are the expectations based on genders, however many that you have? There are five in Die, based on your political stances, based on other things. Are there other ways? Again, there are all sorts of multiplicities of hierarchies that people can put into place, you know, based on who your family is, how everybody, you know, who's married to whom, where people live. There are all sorts of ways that, you know, you can explore that the societies, you know, interact and to make them really different.
And even more to the point, what you do is in constructing societies, you have people fighting against those status quo.
Oh, yeah, always. But, yeah.
ranging from Akio to all the nasty, interesting stuff going on with the Dahai, and Saradin himself is a reaction to matriarchy. I love how people are. I mean, you have all these different societies, and then you have people working, straining at the bit in each one. So I think that really pulls and shows what these societies are and where their points of tension and conflict are.
Yeah, and what I really love about that, and I love this with the God's War novels as well, is I don't like to write static societies. I like to write societies where they are actively, you know, where they're actively people within them trying to change them, because it's more realistic to me and it's more interesting. There's more conflict. There's more, tension. So I really like to make sure that there are people within there saying, whether or not, again, we could be like, hey, I'd love to live in this, you know, society that was totally polyamorous and everybody's nice to each other and they're totally vegetarians except when they're cannibals. I would totally love that. Well, there are other people within that society who say, no, you know, this is too conservative, or no, this is too liberal, and they are going to fight because that is what people do. Like, they are not just magically going to be peaceful and everybody loves exactly what is going on and doesn't want anything to change. The nature of being alive is change. And what that changes into, you know, is going to be up to each individual, you know, society. So.
I'm sorry, Sean. Do you have something? Because otherwise, I got another thing.
Oh, go for it, Paul. Go for it. I'm enjoying this.
Okay, so now you got me thinking about the nature of fantasy and science fiction in what you're talking about, Cameron. Because in a lot of fantasy for a lot of history, I mean, this is the string coming out of Tolkien, is a very conservative looking to the past, trying to recapture the past, trying to regain old forms and old ways of doing things. So, I mean, looking at the Lord of the Rings, what's the last volume of the Lord of the Rings called? The Return of the King, i.e. everything's going to be back and we're going to get Gondor again. It's all going to be great. We're going to go back to the way things were. Yes, the elves are leaving, but we're going to go back to the way things were. Whereas in your books here, you're not doing that. You're not trying to capture an imagined past or a real past. You're trying to, in a very science fictional sense, try to push things forward. I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I actually was had a conversation with Seth Dickinson, who wrote The Trader Bear Cormorant. We had a dual interview at Barnes & Noble book blog, and we were arguing about whose societies were actually worse, and he said, "No, your societies are worse because they are. There's no way out. There's people actually aren't changing. Everybody's actually stuck in this same cycle." You know, in the Worldbreaker books, it's this cycle of, okay, the worlds are invading, there's going to be genocide. In the God's War books, they're basically fighting to maintain the status quo. That, you know, does the status quo, you know, and everything, you know, things change around them, based on, you know, some of their actions that they take. But the actions that they take, their end goal was not actually, to evoke the change that ended up happening. Their goal was kind of to maintain the status quo, because what was going to be happen, the other choice that there was going to be much worse. Which again, best of bad choices, very similar, yep, to this book, to the Worldbreaker books. So, on the one hand, it's like, okay, yeah, sure, there are people within the societies who want to be more progressive, but I would also argue there's people within societies who want to be more regressive. Change does not always mean progress. And I think that's really important. And I think in the United States, we especially get really obsessed with this idea that everything that changes is all about forward motion, and we're only going to go forward and we're never going to go back. But in fact, people's attitudes and things toward social stuff, toward technology, all of these things, they progress and regress all the time. Just because we're going forward in the timeline does not mean we're any smarter than people 2,000 years ago in some ways. And I think that's really vital kind of for us to keep in mind as we create worlds too, is that, yeah, some of these, you know, things are about change that goes toward some kind of progress. And some is about, you know, change that goes, you know, looks again toward the past, or that wants to go to something that maybe we'd consider a far more conservative, way of living. But there is going to be a change. Whatever that change is, there is going to be a change.
Absolutely. I didn't have anything to say. I just, yes.
Yep. I do find the parallels between your book and Seth's book to be interesting, having read both of them, seeing how you have characters at odds with their societies and trying to change it, and finding very dark results in trying to engage with the nature of empire.
Yeah, it was really funny because I actually read his book and blurbed. I'd never, yep, you know, really met him or anything. And then I think I got to meet him in April of this year because I blurbed the book in like November, and we bumped into each other at BEA. And it, of course, it will surprise no one, right, that we went out for drinks and totally got along. And we're like, hey, have you read? And did you hear? And we were both like, yeah, I have read that. I did hear that. And blah, 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 blah. So that totally was like, oh, and this genocide and the book on killing. Oh, yeah, that was great. So, yeah, that will surprise no one. It was actually really funny to meet him because, we certainly have some very similar things about people that we like to explore in our fiction for sure.
Well, excellent. That's I'm glad that book came up because I'm reading that book.
Oh,
it's really good.
I'll be very curious what you think about that.
Well, given that I study empire, I'm pretty sure I'm just gonna like any book that involves empire. It's kind of my jam, which actually is a strange thing to say about a system that is horrible and abusive. I need to think of a different way of talking about that. But on another note, I was hoping we could switch to a silly question.
To lighten the mood.
To lighten the mood. and also, since dark, we're going to have to wind down soon, because we can't have you here all night.
Alas.
So I thought that would be a good segue is to talk about the nightmares you must have for creating some of the monsters that come up in your stories. The most obvious example is one we have mentioned before, the carnivorous plant tree,
God,
demon hellholes,
those things,
which sometimes your book just describes as trees, which is very confusing to me because I live around trees and I know at no point when
they don't eat you. No,
they might come.
They might.
I mean, it could be just like The Happening, right? They could wake up and decide we don't deserve to exist anymore.
Oh God, not that.
Okay, big. Maybe I shouldn't make that comparison, but I guess that, like, it seems to me that when you're coming up with a lot of these creatures, I mean, they may kind of be somewhat background imagery of kind of the world, but it does seem like you have an enormous amount of fun creating, in some cases, just cute things, which is like the idea of riding a giant bear, which, let's admit it, everyone's wanted to do that.
Sure.
But then, on the other hand, creating nightmares of trees that, like, grab people up and stick them in their kill sacks to be melted. So I want to kind of, there's not really a question. I just like, how much fun do you have just creating scary things?
It's really fun. I love my favorite one was probably the giant mountain in the Zezali chapters that like, comes alive. Anyway, that was really fun to write, without spoiling it. That was pretty cool. So yeah, I enjoy coming up with them, if only because, you know, again, the whole idea that people could fall into giant, pitcher plants and like get almost eaten and all of that stuff. That was really fun. Again, finding new and interesting ways to like put people in peril is always fabulous. But I think like people kind of, everybody assumes, and people love, I love listening to reactions to folks who are used to just reading me online or just read my books. And then they listen to me on podcasts and they're like, wow, you're so like upbeat and bubbly and like you have a sense of humor. And it's like totally not what I expected. Like people expect me to be like this morose, like angry, I don't know, sort of person. And I'm not. I don't actually like have nightmares about my own creatures. You know, the nightmare I had most recently was that someone had taken my dog away from me. Like that was aww, my nightmare. I know. And it was very sad. I don't really, and maybe some of this is because, you know, maybe my fiction is just very cathartic for me. And that's where I get out all my craziness and nightmares and all that, so that I don't have to worry about them at night. I don't know. But yeah, I think there is certainly to some extent a certain amount of catharsis, especially when it comes to writing this series, or really the Gods War books were very much about that. Yeah, I enjoy it. It's a good time. I like people going, "What is that?" You know, that's always fun.
Okay, so the other question that I have that's just related to this is, would you rather ride a giant dog or a giant bear?
A giant dog.
Why?
Because I like dogs. Bears are okay, but bears kind of stink and, you know, I don't know. I just don't like bears as much. Whereas there were only going to be dogs in this world, but then I realized that I had dogs in the Gods War world. And I was like, well, I gotta mix it up. I need to have them have something else. And then I realized when we talk about like, oh, the mounts in that people have in different fantasy novels, it's always like one or the other. Oh, they ride giant ostriches, but that's all they ride. It's not like, oh, they have horses and ostriches, or they have bears and emus or something like that. It's always just one. And I thought, how cool if I did dogs and bears. So I did, because why not? Because everything in the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So, Paul, I'll let you have one last quick question if you want, and then we got to wind up.
Okay, so it's a very silly question. I loved the map that you had done for the first book. So, do you have any more map surprises coming? Because we do have parallel worlds and all sorts of other stuff going on. Is there any more map goodness coming for the series?
It's possible. I can't, guarantee anything at this point, because my next book, I'm working on Legion here, which hopefully should wrap up pretty soon. Then I will start in Worldbreaker 3. And though I have some ideas for what is going to happen in Worldbreaker 3, I've already written the ending and I've written the opening. I am not sure if we'll redo the map or not. It really kind of depends on some many different things. So we'll see. We'll see. But I'm not gonna spoil that one for you.
Okay. Wow, wow.
Nice try.
Nice try, Paul. Trying to sneak info out. Okay, so Empire Ascendant is... What? Is it out?
It is out. It's
officially out? Okay.
Yeah, it came out this week.
It downloads to my Kindle. Better be out.
Oh, well, excellent. Okay, I wasn't sure exactly the date it came out, because I'm an idiot. But the next novel, titled The Broken Heavens, comes out it says August 2017 on your website.
Mm-hmm.
Is it actually August 2017?
It will be in the fall of 2017, yeah.
That's so long.
I know, it's so long. This is because there was a...
Oh.
There was a whole shenanigans around this, because Angry Robot had initially bought the first two books, which is great. Wonderful. Then Angry Robot had to stop buying books and things because they were being sold from their parent company. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, Joe Monti from Saga Press came to me and said, I want a book from you, but I need to have it for 2016. And we went to Angry Robot, and Angry Robot was like, we really want to buy that third book, but we cannot promise you anything right now. We don't know who we're going to be sold to. We don't know what's going to happen. And so we went ahead and said, okay, well, we're going to sign with Saga. So the book comes out in 2016, but if everything you come through the sale, okay, we'll do in 2017, we'll do Worldbreaker 3. And so luckily Angry Robot came out of the sale okay. And, they're doing great. So, so as soon as they came out of it, we, contracted for, Worldbreaker 3, but unfortunately we had already, you know, signed with Saga. So good news is, I have two books coming out next year. I do have The Geek Feminist Revolution, which is an essay collection that will be out May 31st. And then I have The Stars Are Legion, which is a space opera about families feuding at the edge of this incredible legion of gory, organic world ships hurled out into dark space. Yeah, that's going to be a good time. And that'll be out in the fall of 2016. And then Worldbreaker 3 will be out in the fall of 2017. I'd love to tell you that I'll be writing it faster. I'm going to be starting it here probably December, January. But probably not, because I have a lot going on. So the goal right now is to have that out reasonably soon. People always say that, oh, I have to wait this time. But I'm like, dude, you guys sit around waiting for Pat Rothfuss, George R. R. Martin, and Scott Lynch. I think a 2-year wait is going to be okay. I think everyone's going to be fine, and they're going to love it. It's going to be a great book, and it's totally going to be worth waiting for.
I don't wait for those guys. They take too damn long.
Oh, I just read other things in the meantime.
You read other things in the meantime, exactly.
True. I completely forgot that Stars Are Legion comes out next year, and I was like, that's a big odd gap. And then I scrolled back up and I went, oh, okay, now it makes sense.
Yep. So. I have a lot. I actually have a ton going on right now. I was not thinking I could make it, but it looks like I might survive, so that's always good.
Hey, you know, as long as you keep at it.
We are pro survival of you.
Yes, I am pro survival of myself. Also, once again, living is good.
Exactly. So the other thing to mention, for you to mention, not for me to mention, because I have no idea, is any convention appearances or perhaps short story sales or cool essays or anything you've got coming out in like the next month or two?
I think my next convention is going to be Confusion, which will be in January, and January 21st, 24th, or something like that. So that's my next one. And then I will also be at ICFA next year. But yes. I have not solidified any of my other plans. I'd like to do New York Comic Con next year as well. And then, of course, Gen Con, which I usually do. I think I'll probably be doing quite a bit of appearances, but we shall see how things turn out, just because with Geek Feminist Revolution, I may be doing some touring and things like that. But we'll see as we get closer to the date and after I hit this Legion deadline so that I can actually think about things like that. So we'll
perfect.
See.
Perfect. I will see you at ICFA.
Awesome. Excellent.
It's in my backyard.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Not literally, because Orlando is 2 hours away, but, you know, close enough.
Well, yes. Yes. compared to other places.
Yeah. Well, have you ever been?
To Orlando?
No, to ICFA.
Okay. I was like, Orlando? Heck yeah. Let's talk about Disney World. No, I have never been to ICFA, but I was told that it's probably a good fit, especially with the essay collection coming out. So.
Yeah, you're going to have a blast.
Good.
It's
good.
Awesome. It's, yeah. I'm glad I've gone three times because it's amazing.
Okay. Cool.
So, and Paul will have to come down someday.
One day.
Yeah. So, well, perfect. So, folks, if they want to get Empire Ascendant, they can do so right this second. It's in stores. It's in digital stores. I'm pretty sure if you ask the president really nice, he'll send you a copy too. Maybe. Probably not. But if you go to a bookstore, you'll find it, and you can get it there. So, do that.
And if you haven't read the first one, Worldbreaker, you should read that first.
Yeah, The Mirror Empire.
Otherwise, you'll be even more confused. Yeah, it's just think Steven Erikson.
Yeah, you'll be Steven Erikson levels of confusing. Like, wait, what? I mean, you have a handy glossary at the back of this book, but yeah, I can't imagine jumping into this one first. Yep. Really confused. So don't do that, listeners.
Now, if you've not read the first book, strongly recommended you read the first book.
Strongly recommended.
Not because you necessarily need to read it, well, that's a good reason, but because it's awesome. So. You know, that's the reason you need. Go read the first book. So thanks so much, Cameron, for coming on, talking to us about your book on your very long tour.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, guys.
Absolutely. And Paul, I love you, yep. Paul.
I love you too, Sean. It was great to get to talk to Cameron.
We're going to hug later.
Yep.
All right.
Group hug.
And on that note.
Group hug.
Awkward ending.
That's.
And scene.
That's an awkward ending. Thank you, Cameron, for helping make that awkward.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.